ICO. Let's make a start. There you go, Miles. You can have that one for free. Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to this latest lunchtime session with DPP. For those of you who don't know by now, my name is Ollie Rea. I'm your host for these sessions. I am joined by two of my fellow consultants here at DPP, esteemed colleagues Phil Brining and David Holmes. Good afternoon, gents.
Good afternoon, everybody.
Hello, hello.
Hello, hello.
Lovely stuff. So for those of you who are regulars, no need to introduce the format at this point, but I'll just give a word on it for those of you who are new. And if you are new, then welcome. It's lovely to have you. So these are relatively informal sessions that we host every week, sometimes on a defined topic. This one is a direct follow-on from last week's session where we talked about information sharing in the context of safeguarding. So we felt like we got warmed up last week, but we still had plenty to say. We felt like there was scope to do another episode, like most people might actually enjoy that. So we thought, you know, let's do it. So we'll be talking a bit more about safeguarding today. We'll cover off what we talked about last week shortly, just so we're all reading from the same hymn sheet, so to speak. And we'll get into some new topics. We do like to record these sessions and put them out afterwards for those of you who either can't attend live or might want to listen back. So therefore, there's a privacy notice on screen now covering that off. And last point of admin before we get stuck in, please do get involved. I mean, ultimately, you know, we do have a tremendous ability to rabbit on, but please do get involved. Comments, queries, questions, concerns, anything at all, either pop them in the chat, I keep an eye on that, or just unmute and dive in. It's always better when we get some good interaction. So let's get stuck into it. Before we talk safeguarding, a couple points on what's been in the news this week. I've got a couple to cover off. Dave, I know there's a couple we've already spoken about that we might want to cover. I've seen this week, I'm sure everyone else will have seen this, that the ICO has provided their official response to that DCMS consultation paper. I'll be honest, I've not had a chance to read it in full yet. I think it's 80-90 pages long. Broadly, from what I could tell, and I'm happy to be correct on this if anyone has had a chance to read it properly, but from what I could tell, their response to it seems to be relatively similar to what I think we were saying, more or less, which is that, you know, it's a welcome opportunity to review our, you know, framework. It's a welcome new take on some of these things. Some of it is very sensible, but we probably have to be careful. We probably need to guard against some of these long-standing, you know, assertions that data protection law is a barrier to innovation, or it's a barrier to this, a barrier to that, and instead, you know, treat it as a tool in the arsenal, really. I don't know if either of you chaps have had an opportunity to get to grips with that yet.
I've had a kind of a brief look through. I need to kind of possibly taking a lesson out of Phil's book. I'd like to try and print it out and kind of go through it and find large documents like that. I mean, 90 pages is easier to read manually than on the screen, so it means I can scribble all over it and make relevant notes. But it appears to kind of still have an infinite kind of a need for strong data protection environment, which is pretty good. In there, there's also, as you'd expect, some kind of stance regarding the independence of the regulator, because there was an element in the DCMS's consultation in relation to the role of the regulator and how that will be positioned off, wasn't there? So they've got a bit of a response to that, which seems suitable. As I haven't got all the way through it, but there seems to be a bit of a cautious approach to overhauling or at least looking at the accountability framework in there as well. So I do need to pull it apart a bit more to give you any more meat on the bones, as it were. Those are some of the bits that I gleaned from having a bit of a flick through.
Yeah, good stuff.
Did Phil have a quick look, or was he?
No, I haven't, to be honest, but funnily enough, on that point of the GDPR being the root of all evil, I was driving along a couple of days ago listening to Radio 4, and they were interviewing a guy, I think from UEFA, and they were asking the question of what proportion of players had been vaccinated. And he said, "I can't tell you that because of GDPR." I thought, what a pile of nonsense. You know, you can't tell overall statistics because of GDPR. And they asked three times and had the same response. I can't tell you that information because of GDPR. I mean, it's, anyway. No, but I haven't read in detail the response. But there you go. It's going to be a moody day today, isn't it?
You've got a lot to get off your chest, Phil. I'll do my best to try and keep us in check. I know, Dave, you wanted to talk very quickly about a breach you'd spotted. The only other thing from me is that one of our support desk consultants this week finished up an excellent piece of work for us in looking into the new Chinese privacy law that's coming in at the moment. I think it's called the PIPL. And, it really interesting, actually, to take a look at it. Funnily enough, even though it sounds a little bit like an oxymoron, Chinese privacy law, without saying any more than that, actually, upon review, it seems like some of the provisions operate to an even higher standard than what we have here in Europe or in the UK, which I thought was interesting, although it does clearly include some provisions which are targeted at stifling freedom of speech and press for national security reasons. You can't see, but I'm doing inverted commas with my fingers. it's very interesting. If anyone wants to take a look at that, I'm sure Matthew would be happy to share his work. Just always good to compare legal regimes. But that was everything from me this week, Dave. That Twitch breach you want to mention?
Yeah, there's a couple of things from me. Just on that from Matthew, I'd be quite happy to have a look at that to see what the comparisons are. I'll have a look at that. I'd seen recently in the news, Twitch had a data breach. Funnily enough, when I first read about it was the first time I'd actually heard of Twitch.
I think you've managed to mute yourself, Dave. In fact, everyone's muted by the looks of it.
I'm back. Is that better?
Yeah, you're back.
Yeah.
Well, I'm not sure.
I'll start again. Then. I've seen there's a breach, a Twitch breach, and I was saying when I was unmuted. That was the first time I'd heard about Twitch. Was on the read about the breach, but that might indicate this the age bracket I'm in. But Twitch, for those who don't know, is a live streaming site. And I had an error supposedly caused by a breach of vast amounts of data online. That could include things like internal code documentation over the documents and payment details. I'm not quite sure. They're still trying to get to the bottom of the size and the scale of it. Twitch itself is an Amazon-based company, and they've basically come out and said that the breach was caused by server configuration change that then gave access to a malicious third party. So the question is whether was that server configuration error simply human error made, or was perhaps was it intentional by a rogue employee in that sense if it was human error? But it's it would highlight some of the risks we have with ensuring that appropriate security measures in place when we're looking at updating and managing server configurations. So I thought that was quite interesting. So I don't know if anybody had come across that, read into it a little bit more, got a bit more detail and any more on that to share. If you have, please do either unmute, join in or put some comments into the chat. And finally, the other one that I'd seen quite recently was a bit more of a concern, quite frankly, was, and I don't know if you've come across it either, Phil or Ollie, was the hidden cameras in toilets at a warehouse owned and used by IKEA.
Not seen that.
I don't know if the warehouse is in Peterborough. The CCTV was noticed in a ceiling void by an employee whilst using the toilet.
Wow.
This was discovered at the end of September this year, so it's not particularly old. There was a number of cameras found on investigation, both in men's and ladies' toilets, and nor were the wireless CCTV. The whole lot were wired in. IKEA thought it was, turned around and in their response admitted that they'd been there since 2015, which is rather worryingly. They said, however, just down the lines of the fact that the CCTV was there in place to support health and safety, because there's regular drugs testing policy in place for their forklift truck drivers and HGVs, and the cameras were there to detect alleged activity that could have resulted in serious injury to co-workers.
And how did the cameras do that? Have we got some kind of clever behaviour recognition system in them?
I don't think they've got facial recognition. I just think they've been trained to identify people snorting coke off toilet seats, potentially. Because I don't understand why you may have them in toilets. I would have thought if you've got issues with people performing properly, it would not be in the toilets, but or at least in the cubicles. But they were found in both men and ladies' toilets, so it wasn't just targeted at the boys either. It was found in both. So yeah, rather worryingly.
Yeah, it is that. Well, it's funny because I don't know if anyone remembers this, but IKEA were in quite significant trouble recently in France because they had been. I think they'd been in cahoots with some PIs and the police force and had been running some pretty extensive and unfounded background checks on staff. So clearly, you know, it's a, it looks like a systemic privacy issues at our favourite Swedish furniture manufacturer.
Well, as a little pun to end it on, I guess it doesn't seem like a good IKEA now, does it?
Oh, teary me, teary me. Miles, have you got the mute button ready?
Yeah, again. Did you notice, just changing the subject slide, I know we need to get into this thing, and if not careful, rabbit on about all this nonsense before we get into the safeguarding. But WhatsApp, this is an informational piece. Somebody emailed me, a friend, and said, you know WhatsApp went down on Monday for a couple of hours, and the whole Facebook and WhatsApp network was down. Well, when it came back up again, all the privacy settings seems to have been changed so that all your contacts were public and all the settings in the privacy section, groups, location, everything was all made public. So my friend emailed me and said, you need to change go into the privacy settings and change it all back to private or however you want it. But that was a bit worrying as well. So I had it all set on private and then the system's gone down. It's come back up again and all the settings have changed to public, which means that other people can see you and then send you, you know, messages unwanted. So that's an informational piece for everyone. My public service. We had an interesting case, Ollie, as well, which I just wanted to raise because people might be interested in this as well. A local authority of our, a client of ours, asked us to review their Part 4 Schedule 1 policy, to address Part 4 Schedule 1 Data Protection Act, a policy on special category data, et cetera, et cetera. So we had a look at it and made some amendments, and we've got, I think, what's probably quite a good template. Again, if people want to have a look at what we've done on that or have got, you know, doing it themselves, reach out, we'll send it out. And I noticed another thing, my great friend and former colleague Jason jumped on the call, and he rang me on, it must have been Monday night as well, because he was driving home from the office, and said that he'd been looking at a fantastic tool that DLA Piper have produced for running all the due diligence on overseas territories. And I don't know if you want to come on and explain about it, Jason, but it sounded like a really good tool. It's not cheap, particularly if you're looking at lots of territories. But again, that was something we spoke of months ago, that, you know, ultimately the international law firms are probably going to produce a tool that enables you to go and have a look for Guatemala and find out all about Guatemala, determine whether or not it's a good idea to export data to each of those territories. I shall pause in case Jason does want to unmute. Hello.
Hi, Bill. Yes, I'd be happy to say a word or two about it because I found it very helpful and very effective. It does what it says on the tin. It's effectively a complex spreadsheet with a lot of weighting about risk analysis in it. You supply the variables about the transfer in question, which more often than not is actually you're evaluating a process of contract, although it could be used for a standalone international transfer. You put your variables in, and one of the most important variables, of course, is the country of the data importer. And DLA Piper charge a fixed price for each country that you wish to analyse, and you get comprehensive information about the state of the legislation in that country, the international commitments that they've made and the treaties that they are a party to. And all of that is then brought through into a summary document with a summary RAG-rated risk assessment. It generates a PDF and it is effectively then your evidence that you've performed the risk assessment.
That sounds a good tool. I haven't had a chance to look at it yet, Jason, but it's on my list of things to check out. But thank you for sharing that with me, and thanks for sharing it with the group. Much appreciated. Ollie, that's really all apart from the data sharing code of practice, and I did moan about this before we started the session, but the data sharing code of practice was implemented yesterday by the ICO. So I went on to the website today to have a look at it, and it's entirely kind of an HTML arrangement. I do have an old copy of the data sharing code of practice went out for consultation as a PDF, but I just cannot find whether or not the new adopted data sharing code of practice is available as a PDF. I'm pretty sure it isn't. And it's just so hard to work with, to navigate through, because you're having to go through next, previous, you know, jump around between hyperlinks. And it's absolutely, you know, impossible, I find, to work with. It's 90 pages long as a PDF, or the old version was. So it's multiple pages of HTML. And, it's just, I don't know why they don't publish these codes of practice anymore. They're moving away. There's a big reluctance to publishing as downloadable PDFs. But that's how, well, that's how I like to work. I like to print them off, write my notes on them, and be able to have a look. But working with it as an HTML file, I don't know if anybody else feels the same way, or maybe I'm just an old fuddy-duddy, but it's just really hard to work with. But it's there anyway. It's there on the ICO's website if you want to have a look at the new data sharing code of practice. And I've not evaluated yet where it's different from the old data sharing code of practice, i.e. the one that went out of consultation.
Excellent. There's plenty in there. Some interesting points. That tool that DLA Piper you've mentioned sounds excellent, because as those who were present a couple of weeks ago may remember, I did some quite significant moaning about the ICO's template transfer risk assessment that I had to grapple with at the start of September. So that sounds like a far more effective solution. There's also some comments in the chat about the privacy settings issue that you mentioned, Phil. It's interesting that, because someone had brought that to my attention a while back, not in the context of the servers going down, but purely saying that the default setting now as part of the latest WhatsApp update is that all your privacy settings are turned to the bare minimum. So you need to make sure that you turn them up. So It's clearly not an isolated issue. I wonder why that would be, though, that they've reset when the server's going down, because I'd thought it was something like a cookie that sort of holds that sort of thing. So, well, I don't really understand it well enough, but you two don't might. sorry, Dave. You wanted to say something.
I was going to say, if they're sending an update out that they know will reconfigure your privacy settings to the default minimum setting, then you would have thought as part of the update they'd make it clearly transparent that that's what was going to happen and not just roll it out.
I don't know if it was an update, but I just got this message from a friend saying, you know, check your settings. I checked my settings and everything was public, so I changed them back. But I don't know, you know, how it's been implemented. Anyway, should we talk about some safeguarding stuff? Otherwise,
let's do that.
just quite interesting. I thought we might have segued a little bit to it. And you're talking about the data sharing code. There is in the codes. I agree. Quite difficult to now. It's easy to read if you get PDF, but there is a bit in there about data sharing and children, and I thought that might be a nice segue through to you.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, there's a few mentions actually, aren't there? Right then, Ollie, over to you. You can do the background bit if you want, and then we can... We can dive in.
Yeah, well, that's great. So basically, as I mentioned at the start of this, you know, we talked about safeguarding last week for those of you who were with us, and there's a lot to cover, really. I mean, we did a new section as well last week, and then we found that, as we are now, we're left with about 40 minutes to cover the topic, which we didn't feel was enough by the end of it, right? So last week we talked about a lot of the background around safeguarding, so what the types of information we're thinking about, who the parties we're thinking about. We also spoke about the legislative, you know, provisions around that. So obviously there's a whole host of statute around safeguarding, but then more specifically the obligations under the GDPR, particularly those that might be problematic in this context. So finding the right lawful basis, ensuring your privacy information is up to date so you can process transparently. And then we also spent quite a bit of time talking about the safeguarding condition, the substantial public interest condition under Schedule 1, which obviously is very important in this context. And Phil had put together a fantastic flowchart that we worked through that went down very well. For those of you who weren't with us, if you want that, I'm sure you can reach out to Miles and he can get that out to you. But those are the things we covered last week. But there are still some things we wanted to talk about. In particular, one of the ones that we wanted to talk about, I believe, was the use of artificial intelligence in the context of safeguarding. That's a big one. I think we also probably wanted to talk about something that Dave raised recently, which is the government's information sharing guidance for practitioners. We're probably worth talking about that a little bit because they've also got quite an interesting flowchart. And then we can also spend some time talking about managing subject rights in this context. So what do we do with information that you know has been processed for safeguarding purposes if we get a DSAR, for instance? And then there are a couple of other things we can maybe talk about, privacy information, potentially proactive sharing and how early you can go on that sort of thing. So still lots to talk about. Is there any place in particular, Phil, that you wanted to start with all of this? I know you'd already done some work thinking about the AI side of things, so I don't know if you want to start there.
Let's just say that we finished last time. We mentioned about AI and one of the participants put a comment on the chat saying, AI, you're off your head. You know, we're only using paper and pencils in my school. I think it was a school, wasn't it? And we didn't have time to kind of explore that, but it's not necessarily the school that's using the AI, because we've got two clients that don't we, that provide software to schools, and they use AI to screen all the browsing that goes on the school network, whether it's teachers or parents or pupils. And if it's not particularly intelligent AI, but if certain patterns of words or keywords are in a person's browsing history, like terrorism, suicide, bullying, you know, that type of stuff, then it sends an alert via the third party company to somebody, and it can trigger some safeguarding investigation. So AI is there, even if it's in the background and you're not necessarily fully aware of all the services that are being deployed across your network. So that I think is fairly rudimentary AI, but it is going to get cleverer. It's going to become more intrusive in a way, making decisions that could have significant impacts on people.
Well, just kind of jumping on that one as well. Did you see a couple of weeks ago that Apple was looking to digital biomarkers for features detecting things like depression and cognitive decline? Because that's kind of getting into that kind of area around AI, isn't it? And kind of being able to pick up on certain cues, for example, to determine whether you're potentially depressed, where you're potentially in cognitive decline. But then what would happen if the system, the phone, the device in hand was able to identify further than that there's some welfare concerns, and who would it alert, and who gets that information, and what happens to it in between, that kind of thing. So I don't know if you saw that as well, but that's kind of all kind of semi-AI linked, isn't it?
Yeah, some of it sounds, you know, very positive, doesn't it? But there's, like everything, there's going to be lots of false positives. And, you know, it's not so much the false positive that's the issue necessarily. It's the records that are left behind that aren't tidied up through a retention point of view. So, you know, you've got potential flags on people's records, you know, going forward when in fact they shouldn't have been there, or should have been investigated and taken off.
For sure, or opinions or decisions made based on those flags that may not be relevant anymore. So if you had a flag showing that you were at risk, or you had a safeguarding issue, or that you were severely depressed, you'd like to think that there's some kind of short retention period that would remove that quite quickly, and not for future decisions to be made based on that information that you had an episode a few years ago.
I think things have moved on a lot in what I'm going to say now, next. But when I did an audit of a housing association, I'd have thought 6 years ago, looked at readiness for GDPR audit, their housing management system was fairly old, and it marked put sort of flags against properties rather than tenant records. So, you know, if you had a dangerous dog or, you know, a hoarder, then there would be a flag put on the property. If a person moved out, somebody else moved in, the flag stayed there. I think things have got a lot better with housing systems now, but again, that's just a bad system. So some aspects of technology are moving ahead at a tremendous pace, like AI. But if the rest of the systems are, you know, legacy and slow and not capable of managing the information created by the AI applications, then we're just creating problems.
For sure. Although I do query whether it's a bad system or just a bad use of that system.
It could be either, yeah. Michael Pendleton's put up an interesting story about the Swedish, I just clicked on it, Swedish town bought an AI to spot children at risk but decided against deploying it. I've not read the details, but there's one thing buying a system, the second thing is deploying it. But again, it's a different probably different, is it? Is it different with a local authority deploying AI and Apple deploying AI? Is it? Does it matter who's deploying it, or do we feel strongly whether it's different if it's a commercial organisation as opposed to a public authority?
I wouldn't have said, Phil, that the difference is in that. I think that the difference is in the context around the use of that product. So for reference, you know, I can't say too much about it, but one of the clients you mentioned there I look after in particular. So I've got some pretty good first-hand experience with these pieces of kit that have an AI component to them and are used for safeguarding purposes. And I think the key distinction as far as we're concerned, you know, with that particular client when we deploy it is that it only applies to effectively the child, the pupils use, because it's in schools, their use of IT resources in the education context at school. So it doesn't follow them outside of school. Now, on the one hand, you might say, well, actually, maybe that's not the best thing because you're not catching a whole host of potential early indicators that are going to happen outside of school hours. And maybe if the kids know they're being monitored in the context of school, then, you know, they're purposefully going to avoid looking up the sorts of things that would get flagged. But by the same token, there's got to be a balancing approach there, and you've got to respect their privacy and their ability to use the internet without being, you know, too overbearing. So there's a balance to be struck. I think the context is probably there. The only other thing I'd say in relation to the Apple point, because you spot on, there is an interesting nuance there. Some might remember that there was a story a couple of weeks ago that Apple were looking at, was it a piece of kit that effectively would rifle through your pictures and look up if you had any images of like child abuse in your phone and report
you. Yeah, I
remember
that. Yeah.
So while obviously I'm not going to conflate the two because that would be irresponsible amongst other things, you know, I think there is a sort of, well, there has to be a nuance there really, and there has to be a distinction. Do we really want Apple fiddling with this sort of stuff? Because again, then it's unchallenged. And you're both absolutely right. You raised the point about false positives. And this is one that, in the context of the client that I help, that we deal with a lot. There's a particular, actually, privacy campaigner that we deal with every 3 months, and very well intentioned. And, you know, they just sort of like to check in with us and make sure that, you know, we're still doing things by the book. But one of the number one things they're concerned about is false positives and how a child might be treated by teaching staff if they're accidentally flagged as, you know, exhibiting, you mentioned like terrorist tendencies or whatever it might be. And they're sort of saying, well, even if you remediate that false positive instantly, you've still altered the teaching staff's perception of them, and that can still have biases. Now, obviously, that's not something that we really can do anything about other than fine tune the system as much as possible to avoid false positives. But it is definitely an issue.
I think so, but I think it's also without coming from a wrong angle, if we're not careful, would the system, as only personal question, would the system in that sense, looking at school equipment from a safeguarding point, be similar to CCTV in the sense that it'll just move it from where you're looking? So if kids nowadays, young adults walking around with devices in their pocket, would they then not just move to somewhere else to get the content as opposed to necessarily on the school system?
Yeah, the IKEA toilets, or maybe not.
No, but you're right, and that's what I'm getting at, is that, you know, there's a balance to be struck there, but ultimately, you know, that part of it also is that ultimately the technology, if it's relatively low-level AI, like Phil mentioned, it's just picking up keyword searches, then obviously that is not really going to catch that much. Some of the kit that we work with this client actually is all keystroke analysis based, so it's a little bit more clever than that, and it can catch things which are a bit more subtle. But you're right, the risk is then you're shifting it, but then also the flip side of that is there's a risk that you introduce this sort of state of permanent surveillance of children, and that's not necessarily the answer either, I don't think. But yeah, so it's a difficult issue.
Yeah, there's three points here to work through. One, the lawful grounds for processing. So we touched on this last time, didn't we? We showed this flowchart we've done about the Schedule 1. But I mean, what you're talking about is mass surveillance as opposed to, you know, individual cases. And I don't think the one condition is built for mass surveillance, is it? It's, you know, the policy document that we put together as part four for this client I mentioned earlier on. You know, it's got to be done case by case. I mean, the policy obviously is the policy, but you know, the spirit of Schedule 1 to me is, you know, we want to share data, disclose data, process data, you know, for a small justifiable, proportionate, necessary, you know, group of people or people with certain traits. I think they're the two things, aren't they? Not everybody, you know, on the off chance of finding something interesting. So we should probably cut through lawful grounds. And then we're talking about data protection impact assessments, really, aren't we? And the data sharing code of practice that the ICO has just published says that you should do a data sharing, a data protection impact assessment, even when not legally required to do so, for, it says, all data sharing. And then the third aspect of it is what we wanted to get onto as well, agreements. You know, so we've got a client that's working as a processor or a controller. You can fill in the gap, Ollie, for a school. You know, what's the agreement? Whose agreement is it? And what does it say? Again, the new code of practice has got something to say about data sharing agreements, because the law doesn't say much about it, does it, the GDPR, unless it's joint controllers or processors. Other than that, it's like, doesn't really say much.
Yeah, that's... So, sorry, Phil.
Yeah, so those are three points, I think, to spring off from that discussion on AI.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, just to add to what you were saying there, you know, in the context of this client I mentioned, we're very firmly a processor. And the reason behind that being that at no point do we make decisions about the particular interactions which are flagged as potential safeguarding concerns. All the system will do is, you know, pick them up. If they believe that it meets the criteria for escalation, then it goes to a human reviewer, and then the human reviewer puts that to someone at the school and says, I think you should take a look at this because our system has flagged it, and then no decision is made in relation to that by anyone on our end. So ultimately we remain purely a processor. But you're right, obviously then there's all those criteria involved in it. The lawful basis thing is an interesting one, and we can probably start there actually, because we talked about Schedule 1, as you said. In this context, I believe, and I'm happy to be challenged by this by those who are in the know on the call, but I believe that there are statutory provisions applying to schools relating to this that they can rely on to carry out this type of monitoring of their IT infrastructure to make sure the kids are safe. Now, I can't point to where it says that exactly. I do apologise, but I believe that that's what the schools should be relying on when they use our piece of kit. But ultimately, again, they're the controllers, and this introduces an interesting dynamic here. And it's good that you raise that point in relation to the data sharing code of practice, because a lot of the time the onus is still on the schools as controllers to make those decisions around lawful bases, around agreements, around retention periods is another one that, you know, we might not even have time to talk about. But all of these issues, you know, need to be borne in mind. So there's a lot tied into it. I don't know what other points you wanted to cover in relation to lawful basis? Because obviously we talked about Schedule 1 a lot last week. I don't know if you wanted to cover that again.
Schedule 1 is only relating to personal data relating to criminal convictions and offences and special category personal data. So if you're just tracking, you know, regular personal data, presumably you can rely on a legitimate interest or a task carried out in the as a public authority or official authority. If you're a school. So only when you're, processing special category personal data or criminal conviction offences would you need to start looking at Schedule 1. And I mean, I can flash that flow chart. So I got some good feedback actually on it. Just a couple of tweaks have been made since. I think it was just highlighting we should document each case on box 2 as well as box 1. But I'll flash that up, because if anybody wants it, we'll just push it out after the call. And this is the kind of thing that we actually like doing. It's a bit of fun to step through the law and change it from the language of the Data Protection Act into a flow, you know, so that there's a process flow. So we talked about this last time, didn't we? And of course, you know, there's two principal routes here. If the data subject is under 18 or over 18, you know, if it's under 18, you have to go through a risk assessment effectively. And if they're over 18, you don't. But we can circle on that. So that is, you know, applicable in certain circumstances, but not all circumstances. And you know, we have a list of which we put together, you know, as part of this preparation of the type of legislation that exists, which you might be able to rely on. So we've got the Children's Act 2004, the Children and Social Work Act 2017, the Keeping Children Safe in Education 2019, the Working Together to Safeguard Children 2018, the Education Act 20, 2002, the United Nations Convention on Human Rights to the Child, 1992, the Equality Act, 2010, and it goes on. We've got 15 piece of legislation that we're aware of, but don't necessarily know inside out, and there will be more, and there's different law in Scotland. So, you know, plowing through this isn't necessarily, you know, easy. So what are the lawful grounds for processing? You know, it's labelled through one of these items of legislation. Well, you know, again, it's a big job to tease it all out, I think.
I think just one thing we might just need to be kind of mindful of when you're looking at sharing is who might be asking for the information to be shared. Because it's quite easy, I think we possibly touched on this in the last session as well, quite easy for organisations to stray into the Law Enforcement Directive part of the Data Protection Act, or indeed receive requests from organisations that are caught by the ALED and having to understand different provisions and how that may affect you, and understanding in that sense, just to kind of just for a bit of clarity on the both parts in that.
Yeah, we did almost touch on it last time, because the law enforcement parts of the Data Protection Act and the intelligence services have got completely, well, not completely different, but different lawful bases. They've got different, they don't have Schedule 1, they have Schedule 8, but Section 18 is the same as Section 8 in their part. So, yeah, we did talk about whether there's a possibility you could justify sharing with the police, but they couldn't justify sharing back. Or vice versa, because we're working with different law. But you know, again, that's probably for a different discussion, isn't it?
Possibly, but it's, like I say, it's just more of an awareness. Because like I say, you could be a local school, you could be caught by some safeguarding provisions, or you might get a request from the police and you might see something detailed. And if, for example, the police requesting something under the Law Enforcement Directive as opposed to anything else, and then trying to then work out whether is that the correct bit of the law for me to rely on in order to disclose that information, or should I be going back to the police and, well, we can disclose this. But actually the most relevant bit for us to share is actually within a different part of the DPA 18, because we're not law enforcers ourselves, we're not caught by the provisions of that, and it's just that clarity when you're looking at lawful bases and where you're coming from with it. Yeah, so sorry, I just throw it in there, because I often come across organisations trying to justify stuff when they're not in the law enforcement, or getting confused by the lawful bases when those that are requesting it are raising bits of law that they're not aware of, and trying to justify it because the police have asked for it under this bit of the law, then we can. And I think we just need to make sure we've got the clarity, we understand which bits of the Data Protection Act we're relying on and why, because that's important to understanding, isn't it?
No, you're spot
yes.
on.
Yeah.
I think what's probably important to remember in all of this, because you, as you say, it can be difficult navigating it all. And I did want to talk about this a little bit, because you raised it previously, Dave, is this the guidance from the government on information sharing for practitioners and safeguarding. And, you know, the number one thing they drive home in that, as far as I can tell, is the idea that consent is by no means required in these circumstances, but effectively just go through the process of, you know, ask for consent if it's appropriate to do so, and if you can't get it, then, you know, there will be provisions there to allow you to share information, as long as it's, you know, legitimate and necessary to do so.
For sure. I think the thing that, for me, really, with that document just mentioned, it was published in 2018, so it's been freely available for organisations to pick up and look at. And it quite clearly states that there may well be sharing that's, that you need to do for safeguarding purposes, where you may not have consent, it may not be applicable to get consent either, without potentially causing further jeopardy to any safeguarding kind of element. And the GDPR and the Data Protection Act really won't prevent the sharing where there's a strong justification. It's necessary and it's proportionate as well. So it's bringing in those elements too, with that kind of for the information sharing and disclosure. But the other parts of the law will still apply, in the sense that if we're sharing information, we must still understand what we're sharing and why we're sharing and how much we're sharing, and whether we need to apply by data protection principles such as minimisation and so on. So there's got that element of, well, we can. The law's not necessarily going to stop you, because they don't want the law to be coming in the way of safeguarding and preventing individuals being harmed. And you only have to throw your mind back to, I think I mentioned last time, things like Damilola Taylor and Victoria Columbia and things like this, where there's various different parties with safeguarding and welfare concerns that felt that they couldn't actually talk or couldn't actually share information to others, and they had these barriers, and they're certainly quite clear that the law is not going to act as a barrier, kind of in that sense.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you know, the one of the things that is highlighted actually in this piece of guidance is that in the vast majority of serious case reviews after the fact, that poor or inadequate information sharing is one of the key contributing factors to aggravating these cases. Just quickly, I wanted to pick up on a point in the chat that Alan makes, which is absolutely spot on, which is that if you're going to go ahead and disclose anyway, then in some instances, obviously, it's not going to be appropriate to get consent, which is absolutely the case. Because obviously, you know, you shouldn't be getting consent if it doesn't really matter whether you get consent or not. So it's key to sort of make that, well, I'd said anyway, it's key to make that assessment in the first place and say, is it going to be appropriate in this case? Are we going to have to share anyway for safeguarding purposes? You know, if you know, it could go either way, then yeah, maybe consent is appropriate. And that's a good thing to do because, you know, you keep informed, transparent, clear approach with the individual. But obviously, you know, you're going to do it either way. Sorry, keep trying to jump in, Phil.
Well, I'm just to say that surely, I mean, I'm not thought this through, so shoot me down by all means. But surely, by definition, safeguarding, posting for safeguarding, particularly, you know, sharing for safeguarding purposes, is unlikely to be carried out with consent because it's a safeguarding concern. And I would have thought it'd be highly unlikely to be working on the basis of consent anyway, but that requires quite a lot of confidence from the data protection, you know, lead to be able to say, right, okay, I know my way around this. You know, we're going to do this and we don't need consent, because everyone's, in my experience, most people's natural reaction is, oh, we can't do this without consent. But I think the exact opposite is probably, you know, most likely the case. You know, we need to do this and we need to do it regardless of consent. Providing we've planned it through and thought it through, I was going to come onto this policy and planning, providing we've got a framework that we've already kind of stress tested that makes it proportionate, necessary, you know, and as fair as it can be and transparent as it can be.
Yeah, I take your point, but at the same time, having worked on projects where I've designed, you know, support processes in social housing, which is what I can tie a lot of this back to, you know, there's a lot of cases where you're, you know, the safeguarding threshold, it's not necessarily clear whether it's met and you're still trying to sort of act in that sort of early intervention capacity. And it might still be appropriate to rely on consent. In fact, it can be quite difficult to operate without consent in those circumstances. The flip side of that being that, you know, the Schedule 1 condition is a clear requirement that you cannot get consent for whatever reason it is. Either it's been declined or it's not appropriate to do so. So I still think you probably need to go through that process of weighing up whether consent is appropriate or not, because otherwise you're going to struggle to demonstrate that you can apply that Schedule 1 condition. Obviously, that's in, you know, the context that you're using special category data. But I'd have thought it's still an important step to go through.
Yeah, pick you up on a minor point, but if consent is being declined, that isn't one of the conditions. So the consent tests are, in the circumstances, consent, this is in the flowchart, consent can't be given by the data subject, they're flat on the floor, you know, they're unconscious or whatever, or the data, the controller cannot be reasonably expected to obtain the consent of the data subject, we've got a shotgun, you know, and we can't go up with a form. 11, you know, the processing must be carried out without the consent of the data subject, because to obtain consent would prejudice this, you know, the safeguarding issue. So you can't use this as a fallback. They've declined consent.
You're right.
Therefore, we'll just revert to this. This that's not how it works.
No, you're right. Don't get me wrong. That's not what I'm getting at. That's possibly a bit of a slip of the tongue on my behalf there. But my point being is that, you know, this guidance sort of reiterates this, and I think it's probably still an important step to go through. What Deborah's saying just now is absolutely spot on, and I think it sort of ties into what you were saying a minute ago, Dave, is that in the majority of cases, not even necessarily in a safeguarding context, purely in the context of dealing with certain organisations, whether it's public or private sector, 90% of the time, requests are denied just because your grounds haven't been explained
properly. And I've had that before in professional sport, you know, we had lots of requests for information about fans from the police, and you know, we got them on all sorts of odd emails and forms, and if we didn't feel confident in the legal basis and the justification, then we didn't disclose the data. We went back to the police and said, you know, we're not convinced you've kind of articulated this well enough for us, you know, review it and come back to us. But ultimately, we were thinking it's our responsibility to make sure we're sharing data, you know, appropriately. But also, if they do need it and want it, they'll get a court order, which is what we told them. It's a bit different, you know, fan data being requested by the police is usually seems to be related to criminal activity. What we might be talking about is, you know, safeguarding and medical emergencies, which is a different ball game. You're talking of a shorter time frame. So messing around with the police saying, you know, go and get a court order might not be appropriate. But I think this, to me, comes down to, you know, having, you know, we have a business continuity plan. We have a disaster recovery plan. It's tested. You know, we know what we're doing. We have, you know, people designated roles. And we need to plan for this if we know we're going to come up against this in our organisations. You know, we need to plan it. We need to brief people. We need to test it, check it works. Right. I mean, the worst thing you can be doing is making this stuff up on the hoof. And I'm sure nobody on the call is. But, you know, if you're not used to the type of processing activity and request to share data for shakedown purposes, then I guess, you know, you're not going to do that preparation. But hopefully everybody in the public sector has and does and tests it and, you know, is pretty comfortable with it.
I think what's probably interesting there, Phil, and I'm happy to be corrected on this, but I think probably what happens in a lot of cases, or at least ones that I've seen, is there is a very clear, established, well-tested and thorough process for this sort of thing. But it's more from an actual, you know, care and safeguarding perspective that that's put in place. And actually, some of the issues around data protection come in as a sort of secondary issue. So the process is very clearly there. But maybe we're less comfortable with, you know, making sure that lawful basis is right, for instance, or anything around that. Yeah, maybe that's wrong. Maybe.
Do you want me to just share the flow chart that was within that document you'd originally mentioned, Ollie?
Yes.
I've got it on the screen, so I'll just bring it up. So it's hopefully you can see that. I can zoom in if nobody can see it. If you can let me know if you can see it suitably there, Ollie. But this here is within the information sharing guidance for practitioners here, and it gives us this flowchart. So you're asked to share information, and it just kind of walks you through as a quite nice flow, very similar to the ones you do, Phil, in that sense. And here, quite interestingly, it says, do you have consent to share? And there's a little kind of little one just hiding here. And if you look down here, it's basically saying that consent, it gives you the requirement for consent to be valid. So it says consent must be, I don't know if you can see this, but consent must be unambiguous, freely given, and may be withdrawn at any time. So it's really bringing in the requirements for consent here as well. When it's asking, do you have consent to share? It's really bringing in the requirement to valid consent.
I'm interested on Michael's point. Last time we were on this session, we started off by talking about the definition of safeguard. What do we mean by safeguarding? And Michael's saying where a parent opts their child out of the national data opt-in, you know, for sharing of children's data, then that is seen, or for vaccination, it's potentially seen as a safeguarding issue in itself, which you might have got a lack of understanding of that. I understand a national data opt-out, but I don't understand why opting out of it would be a safeguarding issue. Go on, sorry.
No, I say that's fascinating. It really puts you in a difficult position. I'd have assumed, and Michael, please do come on and correct me if it's not the case, but I'd assume that that's treated as a safeguarding flag because
it's probably historic. So, it's probably, yeah, you know, well evidenced. Yeah,
exactly.
I think that's it. It does work on just sort of experience, but generally, if people are using the data, it does mean they fall out of the full vaccination programs, so they're not getting their you know, the measles, mumps, rubella, and sometimes we have seen historically that this. This just means the parents almost want to sort of treat them off grid. which so therefore it almost means the child health services are looking into why that's taking place. You know, it's generally a question to the parents why they want to opt out. So probably creates an intervention more than perhaps a safeguarding issue, but historically that's been seen.
I guess you don't actually fall under the definition we talked about last time, because if there's a greater chance that a child is going to catch one of these, you know, potentially life-threatening diseases, then you need to know about it, I guess.
I think we're obliged under the NHS contract to provide those vaccinations and those services to children as well. Mm. I mean, these are people, the record starts obviously with the birth notification and the blood splat, and there's all these things that happen that need to take place, and then they try to effectively fall off grid for the rest, and we have a duty of care to ensure that they get these vaccinations.
Mm.
So, yeah, it's a strange one, and one we keep going back to our commissioners with in terms of, well, what's the right approach here?
Yeah. What do they say?
Read the national guidance, which is very, very woolly, unfortunately, in terms of this. But, yeah, I mean, I probably phrased it wrong. It's not necessarily a safeguarding flag. It's an intervention flag. Why is this happening? Because in some cases it can be that there are generally safeguarding issues. I think the problem is that if we're not allowed to use the data, then we can't effectively, you know, other services use our child information service, the various services, schools, social services, et cetera, et cetera. So it almost stops that sort of natural data flow where we get a profile of where a child is at. So no, it's an interesting paradox, because it puts us in a position we necessarily shouldn't be in.
it's interesting to the data, you know, privacy practitioners, data protection practitioners are in this space really where, you know, there is guidance. Some of it is not clear enough, and we're having to make some fairly significant decisions, you know, to guide our organisations. It's a great place to be, I think, but sometimes it can be quite lonely.
Yeah, you enjoy it, but I regularly hear people rail against it. For those interested, Toby has very helpfully popped the link to that government guidance in the chat, which includes the flow chart, which David flashed up on screen. There's just another point in the chat I wanted to pick up on, which I have to say I hadn't seen this. So, Deborah, please do come on and talk about it if you want. I'd be fascinated to hear more. But apparently, it's quite topical, because in context of recent media reports that notification to social services around women's birthing plans, which we believe is unlawful, which I've not heard about.
I think I heard about that on the news. Yeah, I think I heard something about
that
on the news.
Yeah, I don't think I caught that. And it'd be interesting for you to jump on, Deborah, because I can't say I've come across that one either.
It was just a article that I saw in The Guardian during the week, and it looked like, you know, for various reasons, women who were opting for a home birth without medical intervention had been flagged to social services with no other indicators. So maybe saying it's not lawful isn't right, but it's certainly not in line with the guidance provided to midwives and
If you don't mind me asking, what would be the purpose of flagging it to the social services for a home birth? What's
I think the implication was that the child would be at risk, but you know, or that there were other things that the medical teams didn't approve, and therefore they were flagging to social services. I mean, I'd be surprised if most social services were able to would be equipped a resource to actually do anything anyway, but it seemed like it was really way under the level of triggers for reporting for notifying social services.
Yeah, I think you're spot on, Deborah. I think it's fascinating, because it sort of comes back to this point, which I guess I was talking about earlier, which is at what point is it proportional to, and I, you know, it's not really for me to say, but at what point is it proportionate to infringe on someone's autonomy in their decision making, because you know, there's a significant enough indicator there of there being a safeguarding concern. I guess that's kind of
this is the crux of it. We're all at risk. We walk around at risk all the time, and you know, childbirth is a risky activity. So it's just a measure of risk, and you know, maybe you're more at risk. And where's the threshold? You know, this person.
But it's maybe also possibly going to, like you said, the wider element of safeguarding, because you'd have thought the concern would be ensuring that the individual's appropriately supported, not necessarily the fact that the safeguarding concern.
And I think that was the kind of message that came back from the Royal College of Midwives, that you know, that women should be supported to make a decision and to ensure they have a safe birth, but that wouldn't necessarily involve, you know, involving social services and a kind of punitive approach. But I just think it's interesting because it's, again, it's that, I think the government guidance on the data sharing is really good, and I've used that flowchart, but I think it's always a challenge when it's kind of principle-based, isn't it? And people are looking for black and white answers to what should I report.
Mary's point's a good one, that, you know, again, that could be one of the measures, isn't it, that you know, if this is going against medical advice, then that's going to be escalated in terms of its risk status.
And I think also, I mean, I'm sure we all know this, there's a lot of inconsistency between different organisations in how they interpret the guidance.
That's inevitable, isn't it, I suppose. We've only got 2 minutes now, Ollie, left, I'm afraid. So we probably need to. Have we got anything else wanted to talk about, cover off? Or has anybody got any questions or anything they want to talk about?
Yeah, it's quite incredible, isn't it, how we manage to do this every week. I think that, again, we could probably go on for, you know, hours on this topic. As you say, if anyone's got any specific questions or points to raise, then that's the priority for us, I think, with the time we have left, because that's everything that we wanted to cover. It's everything we can conceivably cover, I think, today. Dave, anything from you on this?
Yeah, the kind of lasting point for me is if you're looking at sharing, whether it's an ad hoc request, whether you're having a difficult decision with, is it something we need to address or is it something we don't need to address? Just always bear in mind that we just need to justify your approach, understand what we're doing, and document it in a controlled way, and have appropriate justifications for that. For evidential purposes, in order to demonstrate compliance with wider elements of the law. Let's not do things in a vacuum. Let's not agree or disagree with where the disclosure should be had without necessarily documenting it. So you've got something to always go back to.
Excellent. I'm going to put it better myself. Deborah's just shared a link to that story. Yeah. Absolutely. Thanks for that. No, okay. Well, that's fantastic. Phil, I don't know if you had any closing thoughts before we wrap up.
Not really. Although we haven't really talked at all about retention, have we? And, you know, trying to put a retention schedule together for the types of information that is either generated by safeguarding concerns or useful in flagging safeguarding concerns. But some of this, you know, might take a period of time to work its way through, you know, a system. So, it's a shame we didn't really get time to talk about and get some views about data retention of the types of information that is useful for safeguarding purposes, because, again, I think that's going to be a tricky balance, isn't it?
Well, you're absolutely spot on. I'm working with one of our clients who are a school at the minute, a grammar school, and, you know, they've got real issues with retention, generally speaking. But one of the things we keep butting up against in the context of trying to get all of their retention, broadly speaking, in line is that, you know, on a systematic basis, we're coming up against, you know, issues around safeguarding and the fact that certain things we have to keep for certain periods of time, for much longer periods of time, in line with safeguarding requirements. And that is a tricky thing to get right, particularly if you've already got issues in that context anyway. So, yeah, it's a shame.
I was just going to answer that without necessarily expanding on the topic for another conversation around retention and safeguarding, which I absolutely agree with. I think it'd be quite fascinating to dig into that and understand more about it. But it would also link quite nicely to the security around access to that retained data because of the information that it contains.
Yeah, absolutely. But we probably don't have time for that. In fact, we don't, because we've already run over by a minute. So let's bring it to a close for now. We can always, you know, talk a bit more about this on a future GDPR radio episode if we want to. And there's no reason that we can't organise another session around safeguarding if that's of interest. So we'll have to leave it there for now, though. Thank you both, Phil and Dave, for your contributions as ever. Thanks, everyone, for attending. A special thanks to all those contributing, Jason, Michael and Deborah in particular. Lovely to have you on. It's always great to get some good contributions, some good conversations. As Miles has put in the chat there, we'll be back next week with a special session dedicated to the public sector, to local authorities, and how we can effectively maintain accountability in the context of data protection there. So looking forward to that. We've got some great guest speakers lined up, so that will be really excellent. But until then, have a lovely weekend. Anything that comes out of this that you want to ask, fire them across. But otherwise, we hope to see you next week.
Thank you, Ollie, and thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you. Thanks, everybody. No, thank you, everybody. Take care. Have a good weekend.
Have a good weekend, yeah. Bye now.
Bye-bye.